There's a book title by Eugene Peterson. He's borrowed it in a quote from Friedrich Nietzsche. The title of the quote is, "A long obedience in the same direction." A long obedience in the same direction. It's not often that you get to quote Eugene Peterson and Friedrich Nietzsche two for the price of one in one quote. So there you go. But that's what I want us to think about today. This story, the climax of Abraham's faith, a long obedience in the same direction. The story, as we read it, you will have been struck by the care with which it's constructed. It's widely commented on for its kind of literary beauty. But just that aching sense of emotion as you read it. It's hard, isn't it, to read? But most of you, I expect, it's familiar to you. You knew, if you like, at the end what was going to happen from the beginning. But of course, the first time you read it, you didn't know. And Abram, as he walks through these events, doesn't know. But in the first verse, the author gives us the lens through which we should view this passage. God tested Abraham. What is testing? Well, testing is to show what someone or something is really like. And testing generally involves things being difficult or hard. If you were a tool maker, you buy steel, and you need to know if the steel is up to the job. And so you put it through the Rockwell hardness test, where a ball bearing is forced into the steel surface, and then you measure how much it's penetrated. Sounds quite painful. If you are a piece of metal, precious metal, you're heated up to great temperatures and examined for the point at which you melt and the dross, the dirt burns away, and then you're stamped with a hallmark to show you the real thing. If you're a sportsman and you want to know what your cardiovascular capacity is, how fit you are, you'll do something like a bleep test, or you shuttle test, where you run up and down, back and forth between cones, getting faster and faster and faster until you fall in a heap, vomiting on the floor. Testing is hard. That's the point of testing. And it shows what someone is really like. That's what testing is. And, well, why? Why does God test Abraham? Well, it's his faith that's been tested. And untested faith is uncertain faith. Untested faith is uncertain faith. This week I had to install a radiator. So I'm installing a radiator on a plasterboard wall. And you put the fixings in, and you measure carefully, you know all the places, and you hope you know where the studs are, the wood behind the plasterboard is. Put the screws in. Lovely, nice set of brackets, vertically, on the wall, in the right place. But the moment that they're tested is the point at which you grab that great big, heavy, meter-long radiator, and you lift it onto the brackets. Until then, the fixings are no good at all, are they? They're uncertain. As you hang the radiator, it stayed up. Do you see? Untested faith is uncertain faith. It is the testing that reveals it. The children, when they're building a kind of a rope swing in the woods, the wise children let someone else go on it first. Faith is proved in its testing. But not only that, trials not only prove faith, but also they develop it. The weightlifter who goes to the gym lifts heavier and heavier things. Why? In order so that he might become stronger and stronger. Things become stronger by testing as well as proved by testing. And so now God is going to test Abraham in this. But that is the lens through which we're to view the story. If you are reading it for the first time, if you're unfamiliar with the story, the big question, not what is going to happen to Isaac. What is going to happen to Abraham? How will he respond? We're told that sometime later, when you look just back, if you've got it open in front of you, just look at the last verse of the chapter before. We're told Abraham stayed in the land of the Philistines for a long time, and then sometime later. We don't know how long a sometime later is, except we do know this. The word that's used about Isaac in this chapter, the kind of word lad, youth, is the same word that's used about Ishmael in the chapter before. Ishmael in the chapter before was 17. The same word is being used about Isaac. It's not a word that's kind of for a little child. And we know, as we heard the story, that Isaac is old enough to carry a big bundle of firewood over his shoulders. No, Isaac is no longer a baby, no longer a toddler. He's a young man. He's grown. He's thrived. His shoulders are broadened out. His face has thickened. He's got a beard. He's turning into a man. And Abraham, no doubt, has watched his son grow excitedly. This is the son that was promised. This is the son that was going to bring blessing on the whole world. Frustratedly, no doubt at times. He has a teenage son, after all. But he's watched Isaac grow with all the joys and sorrows that has meant. And Isaac being doubly precious because of the whole story behind how he came about. The long wait that Abraham and Sarah had before he was born. And God has not, it seems, spoken to Abraham for quite some time. We get these periods of silence punctuated by God coming and meeting Abraham. And we've been, it seems, in a period of silence. It's been quiet. God not mentioned for some time. And now God speaks to him. Abraham, here I am. And God says, take your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac. And just in that name, there's so much bound up, isn't there? Why was he called Isaac? It means laughter. Because at first, when his parents heard he was going to be born to them, when Abram was 100 and Sarah, his wife, was 90, they both laughed. And yet, in time, their laughing, their kind of cynicism, was replaced by the laughter of delight as this son was born. He's their only son. He's their precious son. He's the son they love. And God says, I want you to take him and I want you to sacrifice him. And just that phrase, your son, your only son whom you love, Isaac, they tell us about that wonderful promise and that great hope against hope. And yet every word is like a twist of the knife. Take your son, your only son that you love, and sacrifice him. Seems to make no sense at all. I mean, Isaac is the promised son. He's the one that God promised would be the blessing to all the nations. He's the one they've been waiting for 25 years. He's the miracle baby that God gave them, despite the fact they couldn't have children in their old age. And he's been asked to give him up. Isaac is God's greatest gift to Abraham. And the question that confronts us is this. Do we want God the giver more than we want his gifts? Do you remember Job? Some of us have studied the life of Job recently. Job was tested. God took away all his wealth, took away his family, took away the support of his wife and the trust of his friends. And the test that confronted him is, did he have faith in God when he didn't have all these things going for him? Job, you remember, passed the test. What about you? You've got many blessings. You've got many gifts. So much that you ought to be thankful to God for. Your home and your health and your family. Good gifts from God. Are you grateful for them? I'm sure you are. Which are you most grateful for? Well, what if they were removed? What if you lost the gifts? Would you still trust God if you were to lose them? Is God still God if you're not enjoying all these blessings from Him? You pray for all sorts of things. Things you ask God for, things you want from God. Do you pray that you would know Him better? Do you pray that you would obey Him? Do you pray that you would want Him more than all the other gifts that He might give? Do you pray that your faith would deepen and grow? Abraham, do you want me more than the things I give you? It does sound, doesn't it? It sounds, it's just horrific. It's so hard, so alien, so foreign. What kind of God wants someone to sacrifice His own son? And whilst it does sound abhorrent to us, we have to say that this was known to be a practice among the Canaanites, the people that Abram was living among. This is something that went on. Not a common thing, not an everyday thing, but in exceptional circumstances, you might sacrifice your own child in order to kind of avert disaster. In fact, when you look back through human history, it has been something that has gone on right up even to the present day. Nowadays it's illegal. But you could go and you could report, read the United Nations report into child sacrifice into certain parts of East Africa. That report published in 2007, I think. Right up to the present day. Now, running through the Bible is a theme that God says, no, you're not to sacrifice humans. God doesn't want them. There are laws that God gives that explicitly forbid it. There are people condemned by God because they do it. How could you please God by destroying your own children that He had given you? No, but the question that perhaps runs underneath it is this. That God is saying to Abraham, do you have the kind of trust in me that the pagans seem to have in their gods? They're false, they're murderous gods that they're willing to give their own sons to. Do you love, honor me more than they do their gods? Are we as zealous, as faithful, as committed in our devotion to our God as others are to their gods? How many times have your Jehovah's Witnesses knock on your doors? And then how much time do we spend sharing the good news we have about Jesus? I'm not saying you ought to go and knock on people's doors or ambush them on street corners. But how zealous are we? How committed are we? Bible talks. Paul talks about some of his fellow Jews as being zealous, but not according to knowledge. They're seriously devoted, but they don't know the truth. And we might say the same thing about Jehovah's Witnesses. They deny who Jesus is. They're attempting to earn their own salvation by going on knocking on the doors. Oh, they're wrong in that, but their zeal and their commitment. What a shame us. So this awful instruction comes to Abraham. Take him to a place that I will show you. Do you remember back in chapter 12, when God first came and spoke to Abraham, He said, you go off, leave this place, leave everything that you know, and go to a place that I will show you. Same. And Abraham does what? He doesn't argue. He gets on, and he does it. This kind of faith, this kind of following God wholeheartedly, Maybe you've thought that it's something that kind of young people pick up, and maybe if you've not got it yet, you've missed the boat. Someone said to me just last week, they said to me, I wish I had your faith. As if it passed them by and they'd missed out. Abraham, in his greatest exercise of faith, is here at 117 years old. Which none of you then can say, I'm too old to exercise faith. Faith is not something that happens to you. I mean, there is a sense in which it does. The Bible describes faith as being a gift of God. That's true. But faith is not something that happens to you. It's something you do. It's not a kind of on-off. You have it or you don't have it. It's not a passive thing. It's not a static thing. The Bible talks about walking by faith. It being active. It talks about faith growing. It not being static. Well, what is it? It is to take God at his word. It is to believe you'll do what he says you'll do. To do what he says we ought to do. What does Abraham's faith look like? But it's very practical, it's very active. The next morning, Abraham gets up early, and he does what God asked. That's his first act of faith, to set the alarm for 6:30. His next act of faith, is to saddle a donkey. His next act of faith is to call together two servants and his son. His next act of faith is to chop a bunch of firewood. And then they set out for the place that God had told him about. He just keeps doing the next thing. That's what his faith looks like. That long obedience in the same direction. He starts walking. And he keeps walking. And each step is an act of faith. At each step he doesn't turn back. At each step he doesn't change his mind. At each step he does not resist. He keeps doing it for 3 days. Can you imagine that hanging over him as he does so? The dread that he feels. This is not a kind of rush thing. This is not Macbeth, if it were done, were better it is done quickly. Third day is a significant marker in biblical events. And as he comes, we're told he sees, he lifts his eyes, he looks up. That's language that's used repeatedly in Genesis for significant moments as well. He looks up and he sees a place in the distance, and they're still not there. And so he has to keep on walking. He has to say to the servant boys, all right, you guys wait here with the donkey. And we're going on and we're going to come back. He has to field his son's question without wavering, declaring that God himself is going to provide a lamb. He builds an altar. How much work is it to build an altar? He lays out a fire. He gets the boy onto the pyre, tied up without shrinking away from it. Each step is an act of faith. It is not something that's happened to him. It's not something that someone could come to Abraham and say, I wish I had your faith. Well, it's easy. Set your alarm early in the morning. Start walking. It's not something that's happened to him. Something he's committed himself to. Even to the point as he lifts up the knife over his son. You can imagine the weight, the burden of this, the grief he feels, the pain, the emotion, the questions. But he keeps on. The long obedience in the same direction. Where does faith like that come from? Well, it is a gift of God. It comes about, that's true, because God gives it, but it grows. It comes from daily acts of small obedience. It grows from a small seed. It comes from taking God his word in the little things. And so we need to know him. It comes from the habit of talking to him. It comes from prayer. It comes from devoting yourself to knowing what God wants, to knowing what God promises. It comes from knowing God's character and knowing Him Himself. Faith is taking God at His word. If you don't know what He says, well, you can't do that, can you? It is a devoting of yourself to Him. Abraham, faithful right to the very end. There he is about to strike his son. The angel of God intervenes at the last moment. Stop! And Abraham looks up. And God has provided a sacrifice in the place of Isaac. He called this place, the Lord will provide. On the mount of the Lord, it will be provided. Because God had provided. Sometimes we presume that because God is a providing God, that He'll give us everything we want. That He will make our lives straightforward and plain and easy because God provides for us. We'll see it in context. It is an extraordinarily difficult testing that God provides. And He provides something that can die in Isaac's place. He provides an offering, a sacrifice. Provides a way for them to come to Him in worship. In the New Testament, Jesus' brother James writes a letter, and it says this: wasn't our father Abraham considered righteous for what he did when he offered his son Isaac on the altar? And this is James chapter 2, verse 22. You see that his faith and his actions were working together, and his faith was made complete by what he did. Faith and action working together. Faith made complete by what he did. Faith is an action. It is choosing to take God at His word. It's made complete in what we do. It is that long obedience in the same direction. You ought to have noticed this too. Isaac's obedience. He's a youth. He's in the prime of life. His father, he's 17. His dad's 117. His father's an old man. Abraham doesn't kind of sneak up behind Isaac and sort of cut his throat. No, Isaac is bound and laid on this. How can he be bound except that he has in some way consented to this himself? He trusts his father so much. He trusts his father's God so much. That he would allow himself to be led like a lamb to the slaughter. It's a remarkable thing when a father's life of obedience, when a parent's life of obedience is seen by children who then want to walk in the same way. Did you notice what Abraham said to the servants? Did that strike you as odd? You stay here with the donkey. We're going to go on and worship. And then we will come back to you. What does that signify? Is that Abraham intends to bottle out to defy God? Well, no, you wouldn't have gone to all this trouble if you were going to do that, would you? In Hebrews 11, the author of Hebrews writes about people who display great faith as an example to us. And this is what he says about Abraham. By faith, Abraham, this is Hebrews 11 and verse 17. By faith, Abraham, when God tested him, offered Isaac as a sacrifice. And he who had embraced the promise that he would have a son, was about to sacrifice his one and only son. Even though God had said to him, it's through your offspring will be reckoned. Well, what's Abraham thinking? Abraham reasoned that God could even raise the dead. And so in a manner of speaking, he did receive Isaac back from death. If God, Abraham thinks to himself, can give a son to someone as good as dead, then he can bring back the dead. And so Abraham had faith. He trusted that God would provide, and God did. In James and Hebrews in the New Testament, we see Abraham as being a kind of example to us, a model of faith, something to imitate, to follow him in the way he followed God. Because Christ sees that tests our faith and our obedience, even to breaking point, are still part of the Christian's lot. The disciple is told that he's the one who's ready to take up his cross and to follow. And then afterwards, what does God do? He reiterates all those promises. all the promises given before. Because God, Abraham is a man who takes God's promises seriously. God trusts his promises to Abraham. There's that weird little note. Maybe it struck you as odd at the end of the chapter about the genealogy bit of Abraham's brother. What's that doing in there? Well, it's in there because it culminates in the birth of Rebekah, who is going to be Isaac's wife. Because Isaac and Abraham have come through the testing. Well, there's Abraham and his faith, but just quickly as we finish, I want you, through the eye of faith, I want you to look at the mountain. You know, Mount Moriah will later be the temple mount. It's where the temple gets built, where sacrifices were offered, where God meets his people. I want you to look and to see Isaac, the beloved only son, trudging up a hill with a heavy load of wood laid on his shoulders. I want you to see him under the condemnation of death. I want to see him quietly consent to become a sacrifice. See the father's grief as he gives up his own son seemingly to death. Imagine the father's delight as his son is raised up, having escaped the power of death. Because with the eye of faith, then we have to look beyond Isaac and Abraham. You must see Jesus Christ, God the Son, and his father. You have to hear the father declare that this is my beloved son with whom I'm well pleased. That's God the Father's attitude towards Jesus Christ the Son. And remember the words in John chapter 3 where it says that God so loved the world that he gave his one and only Son. And then in your mind's eye, see the Son of God staggering under the weight of a cross of wood as he climbs a hill. And not only carrying the weight of that wood, but more than that, staggering under the weight of your condemnation and my condemnation, our sin, our guilt, put on him. See him condemned to death, undeservedly. See him quietly consent to become a sacrifice. Isaiah 53 tells us he was led like a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before its shearers is silent, so he didn't open his mouth. And whereas Abraham didn't quite sacrifice Isaac, Christ really did die. And was raised to life, destroying the power of death forever. You see, Abraham's long obedience in the same direction is a great example to us. But Jesus' long obedience, his perfect life, his humbling himself in becoming human, his obedience to God the Father and everything, his being obedient to death, even death on a cross, his long obedience in the same direction is the reason that we can have faith and we can have hope. For those of you who think, well, I cannot believe it. It is too good to be true that God would do these things. I can't believe that. It's too much. Paul, in writing in Romans 8, takes the language of this and really kind of reflects it back to us. What then shall we say in response to these things? If God is for us, who can be against us? He who did not spare his own son, but freely gave him up for us all, will he not also, along with him, graciously give us all things? If God would do this, if God would love you so totally that he would give his own son, he is worthy of your faith. The question we asked at the beginning was not what will happen to Isaac, but what will happen to Abraham. But he passed the test, didn't he? He passed the test, that long obedience, same direction. He was 75 when he started his walk. He's 117 at this point. What about you? You walk this path of faith, this lifelong commitment to small steps in the direction that God has called you to. Each moment doing the next thing that God has put in your path. Would you put your faith in Jesus Christ, the Lamb of God that God himself has provided? We're going to sing. how deep the Father's love for us, how vast beyond all measure, that he should give his only Son to make a wretch his treasure.